Blog Talk Radio.
We'd like to welcome everybody today to On Point. I'm your host, Don Allen, with Mr. Ron Edwards. Mr. Edwards, how are you doing?
Fine, Don. Beautiful afternoon here in the Twin Cities as we look out from studio. And first of all, we want to welcome both our domestic and international audiences.
Yes, yes, absolutely. In the background here, we got some of hometown flavor, Prince playing, and a song Controversy. Because I've been told we've been pretty controversial.
Oh, well, that's really what it's all about, you know, left-wing radio. Whoops.
Okay, well, moving right on. Mr. Edwards, we have some things going on in Pakistan, I think, that we should bring our listeners up to speed on today.
Yes, Don, thank you. Particularly for our international audience, as we analyzed last week here on Point, the situation is frightening, and we may be looking at a natural catastrophe that suppresses the earthquake a couple years ago in that part of the world, the tsunami to the south in Indonesia, and even the great tragedy in Haiti earlier this year with the loss of life, devastation, and etc. It appears now that upwards of 20 million Pakistanis are being displaced by floodwaters that are ravaging at least a third of the country. But these floods are in some of the most populated and most fertile areas. When I say fertile, I'm talking about fertile land, farmland, and et cetera, which is essential for the continuation and production within the breadbasket of Pakistan, if you will. As we said on last week's program, a lot of anger. The American press is, you know, trying to put a twist on it that Pakistanis are angry with their government. That's somewhat difficult in that apparently the most stabilizing force right now in Pakistan with respect to relief efforts has been the Pakistan military, the Army, Air Force, or Navy, if you will, have been front and center with respect to relief efforts in that part of the world. But as we've said on last week here on Point, need to keep your eye on that situation. The tragedy has produced or caused to be produced a very fertile ground for recruitment of potential quote-unquote insurgents and operatives for Al-Qaeda in Pakistan and the Taliban in Pakistan. But it is the magnitude, Mr. Allen, that is frightening with respect to what has happened. It is the equivalent of basically all of the Mississippi River Valley, if you will, as far as in towards Nashville in one place and all the way across to Russellville, Arkansas, or Columbia, Missouri, and et cetera. It is just devastating. Or for this particular region, it would be as if basically we are underwater from Wilmer to the west to Eau Claire to the east. And including the Twin Cities, that would be the equivalent of what has happened in Pakistan. So we watch that very closely. Also, the President Barack Obama, has held or is attempting to hold to his promise, allegedly America's last military combat units have left Iraq, are pulling out basically what is left, our support troops, if you will. And so he is attempting to maintain his promise to the American voters during campaign 08 that American military forces will be withdrawing from Iraq. Now, by the way, that doesn't mean that Iraq has been stabilized. Car bombings, yeah. Murders, and et cetera continue. I don't know. We're not there, but I don't know how stable, really, the Iraqi government is at this particular hour. But the fact of the matter is the American military forces are coming out of there. Now, that doesn't mean they're coming home. Unfortunately, many of those military units are being redeployed to Afghanistan. So, but that's kind of the situation on the international scene at this hour.
Yeah, we also have news out of Iran. Iran nuclear plant, they bombed Israel since that a few weeks. on Iran's first nuclear reactor was totally unacceptable and urged greater world pressure to force Iran to cease any uranium enrichments. So we have a lot of things going on in the Middle East, and this is a report from Fox News.
Let me just say on that particular point, Mr. Allen, we talked about that a little bit last week. One of the problems the Israelis have run into, and there was an interesting story floated earlier in the week that Israel was down to about a 7-day window for any kind of military attack on Iranian nuclear facilities. And as we reported, primarily because of the commitment by the Soviets, by the Russians, to quote-unquote help with the enrichment, if you will, of a nuclear, an Iranian nuclear facility in the very far south of Iran, there in the Straits of Hormuz, if you will. And so the Israelis are looking at a situation that if they are involved in any kind of military strike, that they may come up against the Russians, and that could necessitate a Russian military response against the Israelis. Very, very delicate situation. By the way, also on that note, moving a little bit more towards the Mediterranean, if you will, the Obama administration, by the way, reports that it looks like the Israelis and the Palestinians will come back to the negotiation table. I don't have a lot of hope for that, Mr. Allen, based on the history and based on the arrogance of the Israelis with respect to how they deal with these negotiation processes and how they deal with the Palestinian people.
All right. Well, moving right along, we've had some interesting events, turn of events come out of the Minneapolis Urban League, Mr.
You're breaking up just a tad. Just wanted to tell you, you're breaking up just a tad from satellite.
Okay. I will adjust it in the studio here. Okay. I just wanted to say that we had some interesting events coming out of the Minneapolis Urban League this week. As you know, Mr. Edwards, I spent 4 days down in Atlanta, Georgia, on part of the mission to kind of talk to the different urban leagues around the country. And I did have a great meeting with Sandy Johnson she is the president of the Atlanta Urban League.
Okay.
Who provided me with a programming packet of what they were doing, the kind of opportunities that they have, where they have people coming in that sign up that want to work, and they come for 8-hour orientation, and they actually learn basic computer entry, data entry skills, and then are hired by local companies like Georgia-Pacific, Coca-Cola, and et cetera, down in Atlanta. So they have a lot of opportunities going on down there at the Atlanta Urban League, and I'd just like to say thank you to Ms. Johnson for taking the time out and having a conversation with me, and I really appreciate that. So I also like to let our callers know, our listeners, that they can call in at two numbers. The first number is 1-347-426-3904. And for our international listeners, we have a toll-free number, which is 1-877-572-4288. Again, that toll-free number is 1-877-572-4288. And moving right along with my Urban League piece here, when I arrived back in town Tuesday night, I received several phone calls, and I was kind of, you know, a little bit skeptical because I said, okay, why are you guys calling me? I don't work for the Urban League. But let me explain, Mr. Edwards. These gentlemen said that one of them was a current employee at the Urban League in Minneapolis group home, and one was a former employee who actually has a case with the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights for some practices, alleged practices that he felt his civil rights were violated, and he just he's given up hope in that case as far as up to this point. But I says, you know, if you want to come to me with some kind of information, I would certainly, you know, need some documented things. So lo and behold, I just happened to go over South Minneapolis, and the guy called me up. He says, where you at, Don? I says, well, I told him where I was. 5 minutes later, him and his buddy show up. And they have supplied me with a list of receipts for petty cash for activities from the Minneapolis Urban League group home. And so I reviewed them. I said, well, this is just a petty cash. It means that you guys did these activities and someone spent the money on their credit card or their own pocket and recorded this stuff and brought it back and got paid cash. And the gentleman then went on to tell me that these events never happened, that these people from the group home did not go on these activities. And I then, in fact, delivered a copy of that to the Minneapolis Urban League, and they have not gotten back to me. But, you know, that's not unusual. So up to this point. So with the Urban League giving us a lot of information this week, I also want to talk for a minute here about my article in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder. We also like to thank the editors and the publishers over there at the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder for running the open letter to Mr. Mark Morial regarding the Minneapolis Urban
League. And let me just clarify, Mr. Morial is the president and chief executive officer of the National Urban League of America, correct?
Yes, he is.
Okay, go ahead.
Yes, he is. And so that's getting a lot of national play right now, and thanks to the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder. And we're just looking at, you know, at some of the things going on. And I also, you know, gotten a heads up that the Minneapolis Urban League is having an event on the 25th of September for a back-to-school celebration.
Oh, they're at the Urban League?
Yeah. No. They're having it at the YMCA.
I'm sorry. The Urban League is having an event that is being sponsored by the Urban League, but it's at the YMCA?
Yeah, it's at the YMCA, sponsored by AstraZeneca, General Mills, and Comcast. Which puts, you know, a month after the kids go to school, are in school, and they might need backpacks before school, you know, the Urban League, again, you know, comes in behind the eight ball and puts on an event at the YMCA.
But have you been able to ascertain what is the purpose of the event? I mean,
you know,
back to school, greet the students, get them a job, or what?
Well, I was at the Urban League, and I asked to talk to the communications director or public relations personnel or an accountant, and everyone seemed to be out of the building at the time. And we were talking about once at 12:30, once at 1 o'clock, and once again at 3. So those three times, there was no one in there that could answer any questions or even collect membership dues. So
what is the size of the staff of the Urban League? I remember, I know that, you know, a decade ago it was over 100 employees. So someone told me a figure that basically the Urban League has about 9 or 10, 11 employees, no more than 11 left.
Well, the Urban League is right now, when you walk into it, it's absolutely quiet compared to 15 years, well, compared to 2-3 years ago. You have your piece at Congressman Ellison's office is there in the front to the left. You have,
and those people, by the way, those people are not to be confused as Urban League employees. They're U.S. government employees working for Congressman Keith Ellison, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
And so you have three or four vacant offices on the front first level of the building, which are basically look like it's being used for boxes and storage. Yeah, you have one young lady who's in the corner office who runs a healthcare organization who actually is not an Urban League employee but rents the office. But other than that, that's the only thing they have on the first floor. But I talked to a couple people inside the Urban League, former employees and current employees, said there's about maybe 10 or 11 employees in that building, depending, and not all at once on any given day. So,
and their Southside facility, which is located there at 38th and 4th Avenue, which they received a nice piece of money to remodel that building. I understand that building is basically under rental contract to the Minneapolis Community Action Agency. I think they have allegedly two employees at best, one who's at the front desk, and there may be someone who's there. But all the other personnel that you see in that building at 38th and 4th Avenue, those are employees of the Community Action Agency of Minneapolis, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, correct. And it's a very small staff there. I know I have a couple people that go by there and check and give me a call. And, you know, half the time in the middle of the day, they can't even get in the building. So I find that really interesting. So
how is the Urban League coming with the $150,000 that they received for, is it job training?
Yeah, well, that's how it was positioned with Minnesota Public Radio. Minnesota Public Radio did a story that said that, you know, they're believing to get some money from MnDOT to start this training, put minorities back to work on construction jobs with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And so I actually had an opportunity 2 Mondays ago to press Emma Corey with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Because she was very concerned about me taking pictures of participants in the collaborative meeting. And so out in the hallway, she talked to me. I said, you know, I didn't see the RFP, which is a request for proposal for the $150,000. And she went into detail on how this wasn't necessarily to start a job training program, but to keep an employee at the Minneapolis Urban League that has been there 20 years and he's doing great things. And I said, oh, wow, okay, well, why was it positioned as a training program? Because those of us that are critical thinkers know that, you know, a training program with $150,000 really is not going to get anywhere. It's just going to basically pay salary. 80% of that is going to salary. So we're still kind of waiting for him to come clean on that. So,
now, I understand that that program is now looking for a new director, whatever that director is supposed to do, that Roosevelt Gaines, the longtime coordinator for job placement and training, is finally leaving. And I know that there have been some job offers made. Let me ask you a question, Mr. Allen. Again, particularly for our domestic audience, I was kind of puzzled by your statement of the increase in job opportunities, et cetera. I call our attention to Friday's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune. That would be the 20th. And yes. Big headline above the fold says, as state adds jobs, nation sheds them. State and national economic reports deliver a split verdict on the state of the recovery. And then it goes on to say a little bit below the fold, in Minnesota, 9,800 new jobs have been created. Unemployment is at about 6.8. Now, what I was puzzled by, the story did not reflect anything with respect to the report of the National, the Economic Research Institute in Washington, D.C., who published a very scathing and troubling report that indicates that the unemployment rate amongst African Americans in the state of Minnesota is a little over 20%. Do you have any indication, sir, in your examinations that we in the African American community were able to quote unquote take advantage of this new upsurge here in the state of Minnesota?
No, absolutely not, Mr. Edwards, because that same think tank that you just mentioned, 3 weeks after that first devastating report, put out another report that said that the jobs will not even start to get better or get back to pre-recession levels until 2014, and they don't expect it to really straighten out and get back to some semblance of normalness until for another 10 years after 2014.
So, I see. Okay. So it would appear that in order to bring us off that guaranteed 20% unemployment for African Americans here in the state of Minnesota, we would probably need 15 times $150,000 to even talk in terms of something that's measurable. Now, by the way, that also comes at a most regrettable time, and you reported extensively with respect to the statistics. The report from the Minnesota Department of Education, which talks in terms of a school district that's absolutely in shambles, and there was a columnist in this week's edition of the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, the only black newspaper really in the state, that calls for the district to be placed in receivership. Now, I'm just trying to get a feel here on what is the coordinated effort to put African Americans back to work here in the state of Minnesota. Anything?
There are no plans. I mean, you hear things out of the Peace Foundation and NAS. Sandra Samuels, the wife of Ward 5 Councilman Don Samuels, has repeated that, well, jobs might not be the important thing first. We might need education. Well, with the education failing, if people can't balance a bank checkbook, you know, how the heck are they going to take the paycheck to the bank and cash and figure out what they even have? So the thing's going, you know, and it's just how that upper echelon or those people with a severe sense of Southern stratification, you know, talk to us. You know, and
well, Let me ask that question, because you raised, you and I have been talking in studio before we went on the air. You have a rather, it's a compelling and riveting piece by Star Jones. Maybe this is the time to play an interview that you did with her just in the last couple of days.
Well, yeah, let me set this up. I have a friend, Willie Lawson, who has the Willie Lawson Show on WGAL down there in Florida, Tampa, Florida. And he also has a Blog Talk Radio show, also surprisingly called the Willie Lawson Show. And we had conversated over the phone a couple of times, and I said, Mr. Lawson, can you please ask her about the Urban League? Because she, you know, Star Jones is the author of several books, The White Ghetto, and books of that gender or nature that, you know, kind of talk explicitly about what's going on in the black community and how to correct it. You know, she's one of the people like us that are screaming and, you know, people aren't listening. She's also running for Congress out there in Compton. And so.
Okay. In L.A. Okay.
L.A., yes, yes. So. We're to play this. This is Star Parker talking about the Urban League and black organizations in general from the Willie Lawson Show on yesterday. Okay, we're having a little bit of technical difficulty here. Give me 1 second.
Okay.
Okay, we'll get back to that, Mr. Edwards. I have to...
Yeah, I think it would be important for our listening audience to be able to hear it. She made some very profound, compelling, and deep remarks and reflections about what it is that's holding us in black America back in a number of areas. I mean, education, employment, just the social structure of what's happening in black America, where we're at as it pertains to the political agendas and et cetera. And as I listened to it last night, I found it to be very, very compelling, very deep reflection. Kind of we'll call some controversy. Go ahead.
We're ready now. We're ready. We'll
go right ahead.
All
right, let's play it.
We'll get
it
on. Rolling. It's going to take a minute to load. Studio. Okay.
There were when we were talking about the black community and black leaders. One of those organizations that frankly we struggle with here in my area and areas around the country is the Urban League. They seem to have meshed with a lot of course, the black pastors we're talking about, and the so-called black leaders in the community, to have that liberal coalition that makes it, you're right, political, social suicide to go up against them. Recently, you had some comments about the Urban League, and I wanted to see kind of how those were playing out and what you were hearing about them.
Well, what we know is that there is an agenda of a secular status mentality. You know, I describe it basically as the cultural war being two sides vying for states. You have a biblical worldview that was set in our rule of law as a nation, but you, on the other side, you have a secular worldview that doesn't like the fact that God said, here are the boundaries, here are the rules, and that our founders thought that they were important enough to thread them through our Declaration and into our Constitution so that the role of government was limited to protecting our interests, to protecting us from our neighbor's sin. The rest of it is up to us. To live free, you have to be responsible. But there's a war against that. And so you have those that have this agenda to their core, the secular statist agenda. But then think about the old slave plantation. There are 4 million slaves in the country, and they lived at this plantation. And this, the owner, let's put him where that secular status is, that you had overseers where their exclusive job was to keep those slaves in place. And that's where I would categorize the Urban League and many of the other civil rights organizations, as well as the People for the American Way and the ACLU and the all of the media. They're like the old plantation overseer. So that if anybody decides they're going to talk about freedom or anybody decides that they really want difference and change, that person is brought before the rest, kind of like what they used to do when somebody would run away up the underground. They catch them, they bring them back, they bring all the other slaves out to watch them strip the skin off of their slave's back and gruesome forever, so nobody else would ever try to run away. That's where I put the Urban League. They have shaken down corporations in this country, multiple millions of dollars, and their exclusive job now is to keep poor people poor. They keep them on the plantation, and they keep them in a victim mentality.
Whoa. I think she did a good job on that, Mr. Edwards.
And let us repeat for the purpose of transparency and clarity that that was a repeat of a radio program in Tampa, Florida, which is WGDL, and could you give us the background?
Yes, it's the Willie Lawson Show, WGAL, and he has a show. This is actually his blog talk radio show called the Willie Lawson Show.
Okay. And he was interviewing Miss Star Jones.
Miss Star Jones, yes, he was.
Wow, a heck of a piece, raising some real serious questions. Of course, for our domestic and international audience here in the Twin Cities, which you know is growing as well, at least it was until people started realizing that one of the things that was not an opportunity here was economic growth and employment. We at one time had two very powerful and effective urban leagues. We no longer have two. We have only one. The St. Paul Urban League went under. There were a series of stories, by the way, written about its demise in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, who first broke the story in July of last year. The Minneapolis Urban League is now barely holding on. In fact, there's been some controversy now about the fact that they are having a problem indicating why it was that for the first time in 21 years, Urban League Family Day was not held, and there is no plans for anything in the future. And in fact, I think the meeting on the 25th of September, did you say, at the YMCA,
yes,
is now supposed to be kind of like a replacement for the Urban League Family Day. Urban League operating basically on a shoestring, if you can even call it that. And so, you know, Star Jones is on point, and no one has been able to explain the demise of the urban leagues here in the Twin Cities because, you know, again, for our international and domestic audiences, I mean, we are allegedly the epitome of liberalism, and we are in the forefront of allegedly telling the truth about the issues of the day. And, Don, that will then bring me to a rather interesting story, though it's in a vineyard that is not the political arena, but it is the political arena because it's professional sports. And could I indulge our listeners for just a couple minutes on this?
Oh, please, we need to hear this.
What has happened? You know, of course, sports is big here, and of course, certain teams, as long as they're doing well, are big. And right now, the Twins and the Vikings have done well, and the Wild, which is the National Hockey League team, which is stationed in St. Paul, if you will, have basically done pretty well. So fans have, you know, become pretty spoiled. But the Vikings, they say, are their sweethearts, if you will. Only problem is the Vikings don't have a stadium that they really can call their own, and there are some rumors that the Vikings are probably trying to get out of here. But my concern is the following. Last year, I thought, as a journalist and activist, that Tavares Jackson was treated very badly as the Vikings went gung-ho to bring in the future Hall of Famer Brett Favre, formerly of the hated, quote-unquote, Green Bay Packers, and for a year, the New York Jets. Brett Favre, you know, was courted last year by Ziggy Wolf, the owner of the Vikings, decided that he didn't necessarily need to come to camp, and he really didn't, if you will, miss the first couple of exhibition games. Came in, I mean, he had a miracle season. He himself admits that was the greatest season that he's had in at the prior 18 years. He is now going into his 20th season. And so what basically happened, everyone kissed the ring, kissed the feet, you know what I mean, kissed whatever else, and we had a miracle run, or they had a miracle run, because the black community really doesn't have anything to do with the Vikings. They just don't really realize it. Until they got down there in New Orleans, and defensive coordinator by the name of Greg Williams, put the skids on them, if you will. And, of course, there were all kinds of excuses. And basically, at that point last year, the blame was put on black ball players, particularly Adrian Peterson. Adrian, just an outstanding ball player, premier, one of probably the top five runners in the league. The way the media lambasted him and maligned him, it was if, you know, Adrian Peterson had lost the game all by himself. But earlier in the year, stories were being positioned that it was important that nothing happened to Brett Favre because the players had no confidence whatsoever in the black quarterback, Tavares Jackson.
The way the lambasted him and maligned him, it was if, you know, Adrian Peterson had lost the game all by himself. But earlier in the year...
Are you there, Mr. Edwards?
Yes, I'm here. Okay. And I see we're getting a little feedback. Now, what happened was that camp opened this year. Again, we were waiting on Brett, if you will. In fact, we were being given the propaganda, if you will. I call your attention to the Thursday edition, 5th of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, in which they had this story, front page below the, above the fold, just another day in Farville. And they were talking about down in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, Brett working out with the high school team, and he was in leisure shorts and et cetera, and he's handing the ball off to some players. And so you kind of got the understanding that we were being prepared for the fact that Brett would not be here anytime soon. That proved to be right. The world now knows that Brett showed up, if you will. How can you not miss the headlines? But one of the things that happened just a couple days later, the 14th of August, a headline appeared again in the same paper, Minneapolis Star Tribune. Harvin handed a 5-day warning. Now, Harvin is Percy Harvin, the outstanding young offensive player, receiver, kick returner, punt returner, et cetera, of the Minnesota Vikings, who was the NFL's offensive rookie of the year last year. Just a wonderful young man, a tremendous talent. What happened was last year, Mr. Allen, is that Percy Harvin unfortunately had problems with migraine headaches, and I've never had one, don't want one, but have talked to people, have read about it a little bit. It's not something that you want to have, and it's certainly not something you want to have on a continuous basis. Last year, Percy Harvin missed one game, and he missed a couple of practices, but he was a good soldier, if you will, and he practiced hard, he played hard, et cetera. This year, first day of camp, he had a slight injury. I think it was a calf muscle. A couple of days later, though, his grandmother passed. She died. And, of course, obviously that was a lot of stress. He was very close to her. When he came back, he had been hit with the migraines, and so he missed 12 days of camp, putting him right up there with Brett Favre. Now, the story in the Minnesota or the Minneapolis Star Tribune of August 14th points out Harvin was handed a letter. What this letter was something that is normally used as a pressure point by NFL teams on players who they want to force them into camp, particularly if they're under a current contract. But it all has to be consistent with the CBA. That's the collective bargaining agreement, right?
That's right.
And in the case of Percy Harvin, the Vikings told him in this letter that he had 5 days to get, you know, his behind into camp, if you will. Now, this past weekend, the Vikings played their first exhibition game in St. Louis. Everybody was told that Tavares Jackson, the black quarterback, was to start. The Vikings did something very peculiar. You know, by and large, even if you're going to just kind of showcase your quarterbacks, you let them play at least a quarter, okay? Tavares Jackson, as we all know, played one series,
yes,
in the St. Louis game, and then he was benched, and Sage Rosenfield, the white quarterback, who allegedly is supposed to be the number three quarterback, but, you know, really folks would like to see him be the number two quarterback backing up Brett Favre, and maybe we can turn Tavares Jackson into a pass receiver, et cetera, completed the game. And particularly this was done after the Vikings got a good feel of what the St. Louis defensive scheme was going to be. And Sage Rosenfield had an excellent day. I mean, he threw for, three touchdowns, over 300 and some yards, looked great, if you will. And Tavares Jackson once again stood on the sidelines. Well, okay, we understood that. Now, in the meanwhile, in the locker room of the Vikings, it was already known that Percy Harvin had been told that they were sick and tired of his malingering and et cetera, and that the letter was clear and concise that if he did not show up for practice within 5 days, he would be put on the unable to perform injury list, which if that happens under the NFL rules and the collective bargaining agreement, CBA, you cannot play under any circumstances for the remainder of the season, in other words, the 2010-2011 season. So this past Monday, of course, we were all enthralled with the fact that it appeared that maybe Brett was going to come back. And then lo and behold, this past Wednesday, as we all know, three Viking leaders. I want you to follow this closely, Mr. Allen. Are you with me on this?
I'm with you 100% on that.
All right, three Viking leaders. Longwell, a place kicker who probably gets on the field 5 or 6 times a game. Steve Hutchinson, a perennial all-league offensive guard. And Jared Allen, who came here with some real baggage from the Kansas City Chiefs with respect to some of his extracurricular activities and drugs, were designated to go take care of white folks' business. I mean, I have to say it like that here on point.
Mm-hmm.
Coach Childress, Ziggy Wolf, the owner of the Vikings and et cetera, authorized these three Viking players, Longwell, Hutchinson, Jared Allen, to fly to Hattiesburg, Mississippi, to meet with Brett and to, you know, beg him to come back up. And, of course, that happened, and we call your attention to Wednesday morning's edition of the paper, the headline on the sports page, far the sequel, if you will, and et cetera. Now, in the meanwhile, that next day, Percy Harvin, who the good soldier, who had been ordered to, you know, get back in there, whatever the circumstances was, collapses on the field of competition. Emergency personnel, including police, are called, an ambulance is called. He is rushed to the hospital, and there was great concern with respect to him and his condition and his health, if you will. But now that was not a concern, obviously, of the Vikings when they sent him the letter. Now, the thing that blows my mind, Mr. Allen, is that not a single article since he collapsed that talks in terms of the migraine headaches, what had happened, prayers being said for him, and also the fact that as he was being loaded into the ambulance, this is a copyrighted story in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, Brett Favre was saying, well, let's get some more plays in. Now, defensive players on the Minnesota Vikings indicated they had no intention of doing that, and they were going to the locker room to prepare to go to the hospital to see about Lou Harbin, which begins to raise a question about serious dissension in the Minnesota Viking locker room, okay? Now, bottom line, that dissension has been highlighted by the insult to veteran black players, particularly Big Pat Williams and Kevin Williams, who are the heart and soul of this team on the defensive end of the ball. Now, in closing, I would have to say to you, I cannot understand how the decision was made that people like the Kevin and Pat Williams, that Peterson and some others were not of a quality. Henderson, they say the middle linebacker Henderson is loved and respected and et cetera. Yet when the decision was made to send some players to go to talk to Brett Favre in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, the racism that is a part of the Viking plantation showed itself. And no one has touched it. No one talks about it up here, and it kind of goes all the way back now to Star Jones, okay?
Yes.
And how she kind of laid out the whole issue of pedigree, if you will, and classism and et cetera. But, you know, I felt and still feel very bad for what happened to Percy Harvin. I know there is some discussion going on in some quarters, and particularly with the head of the Players Association, Mr. Smith, is that Percy, based on what the Vikings did to him, based on what happened to him, based on the fact that he is still ill, he is still having problems with these migraines and his health is being jeopardized, that there needs to be a complaint filed, a grievance, actually, as it's called under the CBA. A grievance needs to be filed with the National Football League, and the Vikings need to ask some questions. There's nothing you can do about the racism that was displayed when they made a decision they would send three white ball players to go talk to the white quarterback in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. They basically let African-Americans on that Viking team know that they are not considered to have leadership qualities. Okay?
Exactly. You're absolutely on point. And I'd like to let the callers also know that if you're listening, call in at 1-877-572-4288. Again, that number is 1-877-572-4288. And continuing, I've been watching, and following from our conversations also the Minnesota Vikings and the Timberwolves and some of the deals that they have made and all the Lynx.
Uh-huh.
And it just seems like there is a serious concentrated racist separation between black ball players and white ball players, white front office and black athletes. And there's no reasonable consideration for the athletes that are actually out there doing what they need to do. I'm sure they make people say that, well, they make a lot of money, and that's correct. But still, you're seeing some barriers that are up there that, people like Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and a bunch of folks actually tried to fight to break down. And they're so more present today than they were then. It's just ridiculous. So,
absolutely on point. And, I think people need to understand that those organizations, with the exception of a guy by the name of Kevin Warren in the front office of the Vikings, have no strong flavor of color in their administrative component, if you will. It's basically business as usual, be it from the coach. One thing about Brad Childress, he knows how to go out and get good talent to make him look good. I'm talking about not only players but assistant coaches. / coordinators. He has obviously one of the best defensive coordinators, who he did give the title of a defensive coordinator and assistant coach. But the fact of the matter is, the Vikings displayed at the Twins are just absolutely a joke. I don't know the last time, really, that they had an African-American in a meaningful position in the front office of the Minnesota Twins. Of course, the Wild's position is they're a hockey team, and, blacks haven't attained or achieved the credentials to be in somebody's front office, kind of thing. The Lynx are exactly the same way. They have no significant black presence in their front office, though over 3/4 of their players are. In fact, what happened in the last home game, which we attended, there was one white player and 10 African American females, if you will. And so you're absolutely on point, but like I said, it is an accepted practice here that the African American is to entertain, okay? They get out there, they are entertained. But then sometimes, as in the case of the Timberwolves, people begin to become concerned as there is a significant decline in attendance. And the rationale amongst white sports executives is that we've got to get more white faces on the court of competition, be it basketball, baseball, if you will, football. Again, hockey does not necessarily have to have that, but we saw an interesting trade involving the Chicago Blackhawks and the Atlanta team, in which the young man, who in fact African-American, is from here in Minnesota, by the way, was unceremoniously traded from the Blackhawks to Atlanta. And one of the reasons is to try to make an appeal to a fairly large black population in Atlanta to become hockey fans. You know what I'm saying? And so there's a lot of madness out there with respect to this. And your observations, again, are on point. And again, for our international and domestic audiences, this kind of gives them an indication and a clue of how we, quote unquote, operate up here in Shangri-La.
Yeah, the cold Jim Crow. Mr. Everett, we talked about, in the last hour here, we've talked about a series of events that involve some kind of racial tension, okay? But my thing is, I was having a conversation earlier with someone, and one of my questions is, you have people like Bill Cosby and Oprah Winfrey, and then you have NBC up for sale. And obviously these two people have enough money to go and buy NBC. You know, channel Carrie 11 here in town, and you know, its affiliate, NBC affiliate here in town, and to own all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell them to take their money and get to packing, you know. So if the people, the white folks on that level, or the man on that level, talks to Oprah Winfrey and Bill Cosby like that, just think of the hell that we're getting.
And by the way, so we're all clear on that.
Yeah.
I mean, Oprah Winfrey is a certified billionaire.
Yeah.
Certified billionaire. Forbes, which of course is the gospel, the Bible has indicated that she is a certified billionaire, if you will. But you know, Mr. Allman, if I'm not mistaken, you ran into a situation just a couple of days ago where the commissioner of the FCC, the head of the, was here, an African American woman, was treated very poorly by the white media here in Twin Cities.
Oh yes, and I'm so glad because I was just looking at that. Mignon Claiborne is the commissioner of the FCC, the Federal Communication here in the United States, for those of our international listeners on board right now. And before I get into that, Mr. Edwards, we're having numerous requests to play the Star Parker piece again. So people are...
Let's do it like this. Let's do it like the big boys do it. Let's play it right at the top of the hour.
That sounds good to me. Sounds good.
All right.
Okay, and... Ms. Claiborne, they had – the U.S. government is trying to figure out how to regulate Google, okay?
Okay.
Google got $6 billion at any given point of a day to whoop the U.S. government into submission. So now the U.S. government, the FCC, is saying, well, you know, we have police, ambulances, emergency services that use Google. You know, from the cell phones, the G4 iPhones and things like that. And and so up to this point, Mr. Edwards, Google has been running perfect. The phones, you know, everyone has their trouble with a cell phone every now and then, but it has not created a catastrophic event, a cell phone, from Google, Yahoo, Bing, Fast Browser, or any of the big companies out there, Facebook. And so they had a hearing at South High School on Thursday at 6 p.m., where the sister, the African-American woman, and the head of the FCC, the commissioner, Mignon Claiborne, was there. And I had ventured, you know, whenever they say, the press sign in here, you know, I'm there. I'm there to sign in as the press.
Right.
And I says, well, I'd like to interview. I heard that Mark Ritchie was there, Al Franken. I said, then the commissioners. And
Senator and Al Franken, Democrat, Minnesota. Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
Senator Al Franken, yes. And so I walked in the hallway. Now, I've seen a lot of pictures of Ms. Claiborne before, and I walked around the corner, and I identified her standing down the hallway by herself. By herself. Then I looked in the press green room, and you had all the local mainstream media up around Al Franken and Mark Ritchie. Like, they were celebrities. It was like a Paris Hilton photo shoot.
Okay.
Oh my God, this, and I had my camera. And I'm saying, this lady is down. She's the commissioner of the FCC. She's standing down the hall by herself. And all the white media, the mainstream media, is on Al Franken and Mark Ritchie and these other folks in the room. So I moseyed on down and said, hey, my name is Don Allen, you know, and I'm with On Point. I'd like to film you and do an interview. And she was very gracious. We actually, before we even filmed, we talked about 15, 20 minutes. We talked about, I gave her, you know, I said, you need to tune in to 89.9 KMOJ and tell me what you think about some of those commercials. And she went in to ask, well, isn't that an educational radio station? I said, yes. And she said, well, check that out before I leave town here. So she gave me the interview, and right behind me, and Charles Hallman from the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder walked up right behind me. So I had the first exclusive, well, which was a video, which is actually the only one out there right now from her time here, except for the one at Minnesota Television Network that just filmed the whole panel. I had actually an exclusive review, our interview, and then Mr. Hallman did an interview with her there right after me. But it was very interesting, and I have the videos up online. If you go to www.ibnn.news.com, that's www.ibnnnews.com, and look for the story, exclusive interview with Mignon Clayborn, FCC commissioner. You can see both of the videos, the video of me talking to her, and still, when I walked away and got done, I just turned around, and I still couldn't believe it, so I turned the camera on again and just saw her standing back there by herself with Mr. Holman actually interviewing her now, and just wasn't a part of it. They just totally, I mean, they had no idea who this woman is, was. So.
Yes, and they had made a very powerful person in the area of communications, which they have to come before, by the way. They had made her invisible because of the color of her skin.
Yes, we have a call coming in right now.
All right.
Go ahead, you're live on the air on Point. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
My name is Naima. I'm calling from South Dakota.
Hey, Naima. How are you doing today?
Truly blessed, divinely favored, and yourselves?
Can't complain. Thank you.
Right.
Your question.
Wonderful. No question. Just wanted to let you know I was available and could have conversation if necessary.
All right.
All right.
Thank you
all
very
right.
much.
Thank you. Okay. All right. South Dakota. Okay. All right, Don.
Yeah, that is a really good friend of On Point who is very interested in maybe she should actually call back and kind of talk about what she wants to do, because there's a third-party movement on the way. There's actually a couple of movements on the way here in the Twin Cities. Right before the show, Mr. Edwards, I've gotten a call from three different people. It was a conference call that I was not planning on being on. I told them I had to do the show here at 5, and they took up a really good 10 minutes of my time. And, you know, we talked about the St. Paul Urban League being closed. And,
yeah.
And this group wants to get together and start the Twin Cities Urban League out of the St. Paul Urban League office.
Huh.
And they are very interested, and it puts lots of things into play. It puts funding from the state and a collaboration with the Council on Black Minnesotans into play. It puts some of the legislative folks in the state capitol in St. Paul into play, and they have actually reached out and made some legitimate contacts. You know,
okay, now let me just say on that particular question, one of the things that they need to be privy to, though, first of all, they're not going to be able even to use the name of the Urban League unless they have authorization from the National Urban League. And the reason is, by the way, there is a covenant, an agreement between the National Urban League and the United Ways of America that was consummated about 15 years ago. And what happens is that unless there is a concurrence by the National Urban League for the establishment of a affiliate, and as urban leagues are called, you will not be allowed to raise any money or to receive any money. So they need to do their appropriate research. Also, the Urban League holds all 501c3s. For all Urban League affiliates across the United States, so that's something they need to really look at, Don, if they're
yeah.
if they're going to try to make that move.
Yeah.
They've got to go through the Urban League legally.
Yeah, yeah, and nationally from these guys, Mark Morrell and that crew out there in New York, and I think they're on a path, but we'll see what happens with that. So
right, right, okay.
Go ahead.
We must be coming up on, you say you've got some requests for fact, Stan. We got about 7 minutes before we definitely should play that Star Jones piece again. I think it's raised the level of interest, if you will, stimulate it, really, some reflections of many of our listeners. Let me do this right quick in about a five-minute piece. You know, a couple weeks ago, we had the attorney Mike Patton on. Mike Patton was the attorney of record, along with a second attorney in the matter of Fong Lee versus Jason Anderson in the city of Minneapolis. Jason Anderson was the white police officer here who shot 8 times Fong Lee, a 19-year-old Asian, back in 2006. And as you remember, Mr. Patton was updating us on the appeals process. and everyone kind of had high hopes. Unfortunately, and we're obligated to certainly do this for the purpose of transparency, as we talked about, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, and by the way, for our listeners, national, international, domestic, and et cetera, the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, the case number is number 09-2771, and it is the trustees for the heirs and next of kin of Fong Li, who is, of course, deceased. What is troubling, and I've been aware of this for many, many, many years in my many travels and involvements and et cetera, and of course I served as a special master for the federal court for over 20 years in the supervision of the Minneapolis Fire Department, which folks, you know, the liberals don't like to talk about here, but they were under federal supervision for over 21 and a half years, actually. I found something rather disturbing in the opinion handed down by the court in which they affirmed the decision of the jury in May of 2009 that Officer Anderson had not used excessive force in shooting Fong Li, a 19-year-old Asian, eight times. He fired allegedly nine shots, hit him eight times. At page 14, Mr. Allen, for those that certainly have the technical capabilities, at page 14 of the opinion written by the three-judge panel is a specific reflection that allegedly is a reflection of fact, as the courts like to say. And it has to do with, in fact, I'll read very quickly. Anderson testified that Fong Li made threatening movements in the moments leading up to the shooting. He testified that Li turned his body with gun still in hand towards Anderson in such a way that Anderson believed his life was in danger and Fong Li was going to shoot him. The video from the surveillance camera corroborated Anderson's testimony that Fong Li turned towards Anderson near the end of the foot chase. Now, the court goes on to say that that was sufficient enough evidence for the jury to determine that excessive force had not been used in the shooting death eight times, three times in the back, and five times in the chest. Mr. Allen, I was an observer at trial, as I've talked about over the years, written in my columns and talked about on my television programs and et cetera. There was never any video produced during the course of the trial that showed the conclusion of the foot chase. And in fact, I well remember, because as an observer at trial, I missed none of the testimony. As I just said seconds ago, Fong Li was shot three times in the back and five times in the front. In fact, one of the frontal shots went through the webbing of his hand between his thumb and index finger, which indicated that he had his hand up in a defensive manner, begging for his life. But at page 14, in conclusion of this opinion by the Eighth Circuit, the reflection of the conclusion of the chase and et cetera is an absolute fallacy.
Yes, there
is a video of the actual execution of Fong Li, as we reported 2 weeks ago at the conclusion of Mike Patton's interview with us. And, in fact, you and I both know that he and other attorneys have asked for copies of that. But I'm stunned, though I realize what has happened. And what a lot of people in this country don't understand and know, even with the appellate courts, far too many judges depend upon their law clerks to write the opinions. Now, when this case was argued back in April, at the Eighth Circuit Court's auxiliary court here in St. Paul, the law clerk probably was not there. And you can tell that what they did in this opinion, in this 15-page opinion, is that basically what the three-judge panel did was lifted all of the information as it pertains to the city, Jason Anderson's attorney's briefs filed with the court. And that becomes very crucial in determining a balanced legal playing field, if you will. And I repeat that again. When you normally see opinions in which the majority of the reflections and the writings are reflections given by the state, if you will, the system, if you will, and et cetera, who prevails so many times in the federal court on far too many cases, it's normally because of laziness. I repeat that again, Mr. Allen, laziness, okay? Yeah. the judges really don't really look at the testimony. They really don't follow up on the testimony. The clerks, depending on what their political move is, when I say the clerks, I'm talking about law clerks, really hold some opinions themselves. Those opinions are not reflected on. But no one really has had the heart, though there have been some books written by some in the law profession, but no one has really had the heart or the intestinal fortitude or, you know, the testosterone or whatever else to really raise the question. I maintain, sir, in conclusion, that page 14 of this opinion in the matter of the death of Fong Lee, again, number 09-2771, the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, is a clear reflection of evidence that is reflected on that was never shown in the courtroom. Now, as we said a couple weeks ago, the video was confiscated. The testimony in the court was that that video was not turned in for over 72 hours.
Yes.
And that's at the point in time that that video was tampered with. It just amazed me to see at page 14 of this document supporting the acquittal of Officer Anderson that a reflection would be made of something that did not take place. And I think it's real regrettable, and hopefully it will give our international audience and our domestic audience a better understanding of why many, both in communities of color but also the poor, have a right to question what's really going on in the judiciary system.
Exactly. Okay? I agree with you 100%. On point right there. Sir, we're at the 28 minutes remaining in the show here. And like you said, the top of the hour here, we want to go ahead and we had a couple of text messages, a couple of emails here. They really want to hear the Star Parker.
Let's put it on. Let's do it.
Okay, let's do that here. I think I got it down this time.
There were, when we were talking about the African-American, the black community and black leaders, one of those organizations that frankly we struggle with here in my area and areas around the country is the Urban League. They seem to have meshed with a lot of course, the black pastors we're talking about and the so-called black leaders in the community to have that liberal coalition that makes it, you're right, political social suicide to go up against them. Recently you had some comments about the Urban League, and I wanted to see kind of how those were playing out and what you were hearing about them.
Well, what we know is that there is an agenda of a secular statist mentality. You know, I describe it basically as the cultural war being two sides vying for space. You have a biblical worldview that was set in our rule of law as a nation. But you, on the other side, you have a secular worldview that doesn't like the fact that God said, here are the boundaries, here are the rules, and that our founders thought that they were important enough to thread them through our Declaration and into our Constitution so that the role of government was limited to protecting our interests, to protecting us from our neighbor's sin. The rest of it is up to us. To live free, you have to be responsible. But there's a war against that. And so you have those that have this agenda to their core, the secular statist agenda. But then, think about the old slave plantation. There are 4 million slaves in the country, and they live in this plantation. And this, the owner, let's put him where that secular statist is, that you had overseers where their exclusive job was to keep those slaves in place. And that's where I would categorize the Urban League and many of the other civil rights organizations, as well as the People for the American Way and the ACLU and the all of the media. They're like the old plantation overseer, so that if anybody decides they're going to talk about freedom or anybody decides that they really want difference and change, that person is brought before the rest, kind of like what they used to do when somebody would run away up the underground. They catch them, they bring them back, they bring all the other slaves out to watch them strip the skin off of that slave's back and bruise them forever so nobody else would ever try to run away. That's where I put the Urban League. They have shaken down corporations in this country, multiple millions of dollars, and their exclusive job now is to keep poor people poor. They keep them on the plantation and to keep them in a victim mentality.
Wow. Again, I'm just amazed at
Mr. Allen, I think it's important to, for again, transparency, man, because that is a powerful reflection. That was radio station in Tampa, Florida. Could you again give us the call letters of the station and the program host there in Tampa, Florida?
It's actually the Willie Lawson Show, who has a show on Blog Talk Radio called The Willie Lawson Show, who interviewed Ms. Parker on yesterday at 12 o'clock Eastern Time. And he's also a radio personality at WGAL down there in Florida, and a really popular guy. And I just touched base with him, and he just laid the question out there because, you know, Star Parker had said in an earlier article that I had read that me and Mr. Lawson was talking about, she had said that, you know, there's a problem with the Urban League on a national basis. It seems like every program that they try to create relies heavily on a government program.
That's absolutely correct, right?
There are no people inside of the organization that can idea, create, and implement anything. And so we also kind of went into some conversation. You know, every one of these cities, especially down in Florida and even here in Minneapolis, the Twin Cities, you know, we have three or four professional sports teams. These guys are multimillionaires. There's no line of cordial and diplomatic conversation to maybe say, go to these guys and say, this is what we want to do. We want to do some kind of action to get people jobs, some kind of action to get people better education. Would you be involved? Would I like to be involved with this? Those conversations are not going on, you know, so.
Absolutely. Mr. Allen, let me do this. Our numbers again, if one has any observations, 347-426-3904, and our toll-free number, 877-572-4288. On point, Don Allen, Ron Edwards, we welcome your calls, your reflections, particularly based on the the analysis Star Jones just made that was captured yesterday on Radio Blog out of Tampa, Florida. Go ahead, Mr. Allen.
Well, you know, I don't think that people are going to call in and challenge that at all. I mean, you have a few out there that might pick up the phone or might be listening right now to the show. And it's kind of interesting just to hear, you know, the deafening silence when the truth comes out.
Yes, it is. Let's do this for them. You know, we had also said as part of our agenda for today here on Point, she made a profound and compelling reflection as pertains to Constitution, if you will. We haven't talked about the mosque and the controversy. And let me say this to generate a little kind of response in the give and take between us. I find it amazing that President Barack Obama is under attack for indicating, though he was not going to speak to how wise a choice it was, but the fact of the matter is that the Constitution protects religious freedom. I have been amazed at the attack upon him by both the left and the right to some degree, and the declaration being made towards him, notice I said declaration, that the Constitution is not at play here. It's all about sensitivity, and I mean, God knows that we're all sensitive. I mean, 2,984 people by official count perished in the Twin Towers. The President of the United States, when Barack Obama, as 43 others before him, took the oath of office in January 2009, he swore to uphold the Constitution of the United States of America. He did not swear to, quote-unquote, uphold the sensitivities of Don Allen, Ron Edwards, or anybody else, or Bugs Bunny, okay? And I'm just taken back, but it's frightening because it lets you know that it's a saying that I've had, Mr. Allen, for many, many years, as you can remember, that we as African-Americans believe in the system more than the system believes in itself. And we better understand that with respect to the current attack against President Barack Obama and the developers of the mosque and et cetera. Now, you know, Governor Patterson, the governor of New York, African-American, if you will, has proposed a exchange of land, giving the developer, Mr. Khan, a parcel of land about 30 blocks north of the so-called sacred ground, in exchange for the land that he is going to build, quote unquote. And it's not a mosque. He's building a social service building. That's really what it's about. It had a multiplicity of things. But we better be on guard, as Star Jones said in that very excellent piece. We better understand how folks who have no concern with respect to our rights and our future as African Americans can take the Constitution and twist it any way they want. And I want to repeat that again in conclusion. I find it absolutely chilling that President Barack Obama is being told that the issue is not the Constitution, the issue is be damned with religious freedom and et cetera, that it's about sensitivity. Well, let me say this. I'm quite sure in 1860, and certainly in 1863, there were a lot of slaveholders that were very sensitive to the fact that their free labor was being taken away from them under the Emancipation Proclamation. Go right ahead, Mr. Allen.
Yeah, we have a call.
Okay, go right ahead.
Yes, go ahead, please. Tell me who you are, where you're calling from.
Let me say this. I'm quite sure in 1860, and certainly in
1860... Hello, can you turn your radio down, please?
Yeah, because we're getting feedback.
Yeah.
Free labor was being taken away.
Okay, we're just going to hang up on them.
Okay.
Listening in on their phone. We have a couple people that do that are near their computers and tune in on the phone, and then they call in because, you know, the technology lets you listen to it. But you can't, if you have a smartphone device, I would just like to advise you, go to your web browser and put in http://. blogtalkradio.com/IBNN News, and you can walk around with your cell phone all day and listen to this broadcast if you'd like. So we just
that's right. I remember one of our first callers in week two called us from the airport in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Because they knew how to electronically handle that in that manner. But those are my observations, Mr. Allen. In the what do we have here? About 13-14 minutes.
We have about 18 minutes here left remaining, and I do want to get into the political piece because there's some growing concerns here in Minneapolis of some distribution of some local news that it just doesn't seem up to par. It's not fresh, it's old and antiquated, and it looks like the people aren't falling for it. But we do have another caller. Let's see what they're if they've turned down their radio here.
Okay.
Yes, go ahead. You're live on the air.
Yes, this is, again, Naima. This is very good that you're bringing this as it is.
Yes. Go ahead.
Thank you. Give us some of your thoughts, Naima, some of your thoughts with respect to what you're listening to.
Well, first of all, Mr. Edwards, being older than 50, I remember a lot of the things that were going on. And you have been on point for a very, very long time. And isn't it interesting that you're still having to talk about some of the same things?
Yes, it is, and I'm in the 71st year of my life. Thank you. I appreciate the reflection. It is frightening, isn't it? And, you know, I had the pleasure of having my contemporaries and peers tell me that this would happen. I guess when I was a 20-some-year-old, I didn't really want to believe, though I was a critic and have continued. I really didn't want to believe that 50 years later it would be still the same thing. It's frightening. Go right ahead, though.
It is frightening, but the thing is that America, middle, upper, lower, around the way, go for it, wherever, doesn't realize that it's more frightening than one would think. Madoff hit a lot of people. There are a lot of people who have lost their pensions and a few other things, along with jobs and so on, but people don't talk about that per se. They want to make it, when they do talk about it, they want to make it to be a fear of, which is what I really wanted to say in the beginning, that all of this from the Willie Lynch letters, Madoff and the scams and everything else is a society of fear. When you want to go back, when you talk about the Middle Passage, all of the Middle Passage, whether you look at one movie or another, pretty much historically was there were Muslims that were brought over, there were people that were brought over, we weren't allowed to talk to each other, so on and so forth. Not a history lesson, but just go back and remember. Fear and separation. Separation and fear. It's all about the ability to do that. One gets paid more money. Golden parachutes, when you can sell off a piece get more, lay people off. I was in the cab in Minnesota a long time ago, back in 99, and there were some people that were in the car, and they had taken away 25,000 jobs and given themselves each a $5,000 a year bonus for having done something like that. Well, now, I'm not a person that's going to do anything crazy, but I did sort of think about smacking them, you know, because it was like the Three Stooges, but I'm not a violent woman. This was back in 1990, and so it still continues. Fear, being able to keep people fearful, lets us still be here talking about what we should be afraid of. First, it was driving while black. Ooh. And then it was driving while Muslim. Ooh, what's next?
Right. Let me just clarify again, both for our domestic and international audiences, folks, that Madoff is the gentleman who pulled one of the greatest Ponzi's in the history of this country, who, by the way, it's interesting because last night CNN announced that they're going to be doing a piece, a kind of a human interest piece, because poor Bernie Madoff, is, you know, he's in a federal penitentiary in northern North Carolina.
Oh,
and they're really
goodness.
Concerned, and I'd be, if I was Bernie, I'd be concerned too, based on what's happened, that he, quote unquote, may succumb to suicide, and that he has been the target of violent threats of death inside the federal detention center that he is in. And so CNN is going to do this piece. I don't know if it's tonight or tomorrow. They're going to do this piece about poor Bernie Madoff.
Well, the sacrificial lamb. You know, there are a lot of people who had moms and dads, older people, that now they're going to have to have them in their houses instead of being in Florida, but Florida's too hot. That's one of those other things about the weather. But so you have a lot of different things that are going on there. Bernie is the sacrificial lamb, as far as I'm concerned, as far as what I see in the chess game. And, oh, it, by the way, I kind of look at what's going on in the days of our lives as a chess game, always one step ahead in making sure if anybody ever tries to get together, oh, you can't go with them, because if you go with them, if you talk to them, then you might be in big trouble, because you know they're going to be targeted today. Driving while black, driving while Muslim, driving while white. Ooh, it just could get to that point.
Right. Appreciate it. Thank you. Don, you got anything on your end?
Well, if Naima can stay with us here, because she'll bear witness to what I was getting ready to go into.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to go into the – let me just get back to the switchboard here. Okay, yeah, it looks like she didn't – are you there, Naima?
I'm still here.
Okay. Well, the reason why I have her staying there is because we're friends on Facebook, and I have been battling the representatives from the Minnesota GOP, the Republican Party of Minnesota. But before I get to that piece, Mr. Edwards, this week, I don't know for our local listeners here in the Twin Cities, on the front cover of the newspaper above the fold on the Insight News was a story that Mark Dayton's win in the DFL primary was an upset.
What a stupid editorial. I mean, our headline. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I went further to look into the article, and I countered it because I said Mark Dayton's win in the VFL primary is not an upset. And if you want to look at, our community has been saturated with information by a certain group of people. Like, this is what you buy in the grocery store. This is who you vote for that are running for politics or office. And these are the people you like, and these are the people that you don't like. Well, in this case, the Insight News here locally, we ran ads for the primary for Matt and Tenza and Robin Robinson, but those of us on the inside knew that the Robinson and Tenza ticket didn't have a chance, didn't have a snowball chance in Hades to do anything. But still, you know, you had these articles being distributed all over the place, the ads being read, like, you know, this was the prima donna of politics in Minnesota. Robin Robinson and Matt and Tenza have brought the black community out of the sheds onto the plantations next to the cotton fields so they can go vote. And that was so far from the truth, and I just didn't like it. So I ended up countering that with another article that said, you know, Mark Dayton's primary win is not an upset, and went into some factual documented information and some editorial on why it wasn't. And so we're getting pretty tired of seeing this kind of stuff every time there's an election, because for that particular newspaper, this is strike two. Strike one was last year when it endorsed Kenya McKnight for Ward 5, okay, which we know.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
On point.
Yeah, which we know she didn't win, and she's a political midget, basically, or small person. Sorry for being on the pin. But you know,
absolutely.
In that case, you know, also, too, we're talking about the Republican Party, the 5th Ward, or excuse me, the 5th Congressional District. You have our Congressman Keith Ellison. You have the Republican GOP-endorsed candidate running against him, who is Joel Demos. Well, I had, another anonymous email sent to the Independent Business News Network, which I went ahead and just followed up on. And I couldn't believe it. The Republican GOP endorsed Republican candidate, you know, Mr. Evers, let me ask you this. If you're an endorsed Republican candidate or GOP candidate for Congress, doesn't there some kind of prestige come with that? Some level of a upper playing field? I don't care if you're GOP or DFL.
Most definitely. First of all, the party is supposed to swing in behind you. There's money that comes out of the party treasury that is supposed to be made available to you, campaign workers, and et cetera. But let me just say, Mr. Allen, interesting story. Again, USA Today for this week, you know, USA Today on the weekends, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Interesting story. People need to check it out, in which the Republicans now, as a part of this battle with the Tea Party, are whining and crying about the divisiveness that is beginning to take place within the Republican Party as an outgrowth of some of these primary contests. And we would call your attention to page 6A of Friday's August 20th edition of USA Today. Republican primary bruises not healing quickly. And they talk in terms of Nevada, Colorado, Connecticut, and Washington State. Rather interesting article. For those that have not yet seen it, you may want to read it, because Mr. Allen is absolutely on point. Because actually, that's what's happening here in Minnesota with the GOP. Tea Party is having a real impact, and there's a lot of ugliness going on.
And yes, there is. And also, I'm looking at it here. You can go to USA.com, USAtoday.com, and the story is right there.
Oh,
and,
good. Excellent.
And so you can get it online. But anyway, because we have 7 minutes left here, I found out that the GOP-endorsed candidate for Congress for the 5th Congressional District, Joel Demos, is working two full-time jobs. He has raised a little bit under $25,000. There are allotments going out for management in excess of $10,000. This is what the GOP does. They get someone and they throw them under the bus. And I actually published his FEC report, campaign finance report, online because I couldn't believe this. Now, I tried to call the Minnesota GOP. Of course, they do not want to talk to me because I launched a campaign to take over the chairmanship of communications. I told them I was going to strategically dismantle every one of the high-profile GOP candidates from governor. Well, we don't have to worry about the governor and the fifth CD at all, because Congressman Ellison and Dayton should do a very Mark Dayton and Mr. Dayton do a very good job. But you have
You're breaking up just a tad.
Okay, I'll go back to this one. Then okay, we have the Secretary of State, Dan Severson, who's a GOP endorsed, State Auditor Pat Anderson endorsed, and the Michelle Bachman and folks like that. Michelle Bachman
up in the 6th Congressional District, that's St. Cloud, Sauk Rapids, and et cetera, who, by the way, need to point out, Michelle Bachman, for our domestic listeners, is in trouble in the 6th Congressional District. She is in trouble. Dead heat up there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Terrell Clark is planning on taking her out. And they actually, it was really nice of them, Mr. Edwards. I did a story about Michelle Bachman and the trouble that she's going to have this year, and I sent it over there to them, and they actually sent me an email back and said, thank you very much. That's more than I got out of any of the Republican Party. So I actually went on this campaign with a network of 200 bloggers across the country. We're not targeting all the Republican candidates, just the high-profile candidates here in the state of Minnesota.
Let me go back to, quickly to the 25,000. You say that the candidate challenger, Republican challenger in the 5th Congressional District against incumbent two-term Congressman Keith Ellison has raised a grand total of 25,000?
Just under 25,000.
You know, it goes to show you how money makes a difference. I mean, Congressman Ellison spent that much on food in his most recent trip to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, easily. Yeah. I mean, you're looking at someone that has the access or control to get, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I also, just to kind of rub it in their face, the Minnesota GOP or the Republican Party of Minnesota, I wrote an open letter to Congressman Ellison that says, hey, you could stop running today because there's no one that's going to be able to launch an attack against you to not be elected. So why waste the money?
Well, what he's doing is building up his campaign chest for his run in 2012, which, by the way, is a presidential election, and it means a whole lot more people will come out in the 5th Congressional District. I mean, his strategic handlers are clearly indicating that 2012 could be a problem for Congressman Ellison. Right now, you're absolutely correct. The election this year, 2010, he's in like Flynn, if you will. 2012 is the one that you need to watch because the Tea Party and others are baking a cake across the country for 2012. So you raise a question that I think is self-explanatory. He's getting his war chest together to protect his flanks in his election in 2012.
Yeah, yes. And so we're watching that. We're watching that very, very closely. And we're putting out a series of stories. And I just got fed up. They do have one guy on Facebook that keeps telling me that I'm the Jesse Jackson of Minneapolis, that if you don't go my way and that I'm going to get upset. And they don't understand. They haven't given me a nickel. They've called me and said, hey, can you tell us what you think? And I says, you know, well, are you asking for a consultant? I'm not turning on the lights for you guys at all. And so there are things they can do. But, I mean, it's pretty much hopeless in 2010 for the Minnesota GOP and the majority of its candidates.
Well, I think their candidates need to understand that, again, the strategy that I just indicated in preparation for the election 2012 is that, unfortunately, it seems that most of the Republican candidates, particularly for statewide offices, are sacrificial lambs.
Yeah, yeah, and they're just – they have them up there. I mean, this happened in 2008. You had a great guy, Cummings, up in Duluth. He probably could have won Duluth, but you know what? He had to go around and raise money by taking windows out of old buildings and selling them because the Minnesota GOP was too busy behind Bachman and Klein.
The 8th Congressional District, which is Duluth, has been a Democratic stronghold since statehood for Minnesota.
You're right.
Yeah, I don't think a Republican's won office up there in the 8th Congressional in the last 80 years. I'm talking about even as mayor of a township. But, you know, keep in mind, our sense in the last 2.5 minutes is that the Republicans need to confirm and admit that their host of candidates for election 2010 here in Minnesota are basically sacrificial lambs. The Democrats better watch closely 2012. They need to be happy that they'll hopefully have after 24 years, we'll have the state house secured. But they've got some problems with respect to their congressional seats, McCollum and Ellison in the 4th and the 5th, as well as in the state house or in the state legislature, both the House and the Senate. They better keep their eye on it. Mr. Allen, we're down to the last couple of minutes. Anything we need to say to our listening audience?
Well, we just want to say, if you're in Minneapolis, tune in to the Minneapolis Television Network tomorrow morning at 5 p.m. at Central Standard Time. Well, of course, if you're in Minneapolis, it's going to be Central Standard Time for Black Focus. Two guys, Mr. Ron Edwards, television show there and toggle. Find out what's going on here. Also, next week, the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, Mr. Eric, you'll find Mr. Edwards in that newspaper where he writes a weekly column. Also, I'd like to say thank you to the McIntosh Studios for letting us use the state-of-the-art studios here, and we're just, you know, kind of getting our hands wet here, getting used to it. It's really plush, really nice. We'd like to say thank you to the McIntosh Studios.
And thank you to our sponsors in Toronto, Canada.
Yeah, thank you, Toronto, Virtual Global Media Group. We'd like to thank them also. We'd like to thank Mr. Willie Lawson from the Willie Lawson Show on Blog Talk Radio and WGAL in Florida down there for quickly giving me the MP3 of Ms. Tara Jones. We'd like to thank everybody for listening. We'll be back next week, same time, same station, more dynamic talk. And
God bless.
And God bless, and thank you for listening to On Point.
All right.